Hi, welcome back to another episode of Real World Serverless, a podcast where I speak with real world practitioners and get their stories from the trenches. Today, I'm joined by Eric Peterson, who's the founder and the CTO of CloudZero, who is one of the leading companies in the cloud cost management space. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Jan. Great to see you again.
Long time no see. I guess we first meet each other after I did a talk at the Monitorama, where I kind of drafted out a screenshot of what I want to see from my observability tools and how it's going to help me understand what's going on in my serverless application. And then you messaged me afterwards to say, that's exactly what we've built.
Yeah, I couldn't believe it back then when I think I was sitting there watching that, and I if I had had a drink in my hand, I would have spit it out, because you were like so spot on in what you were thinking back then. You know, a lot of people weren't necessarily thinking about how the operations of their systems are tied into all of these dimensions, and cost being one of those things. And and kind of connecting all the dots, particularly in serverless systems. I knew in that moment that if we didn't start talking, it would be a huge mistake. So I'm glad we got a chance to connect then, and it's always been an interesting conversation every time we get a chance to connect again.
Yeah, and you guys started off with serverless observability, and then later pivoted to sort of cloud cost monitoring. And I think some of the things that you guys have done early on with serverless and observability has really put a new angle to how you sort of tackle the problem of understanding where your cloud cost is happening, and understanding those subtle changes in your spending patterns. Maybe before we get into that, do you want to spend a few moments and talk about your experience and CloudZero and what do you guys do?
Sure, I'd love to. You know, we're huge believers in serverless. We have been from the beginning. I think one of those magical things you get to do as a founder when you start a company is kind of pick the technology stack and some of the choices that you will then live with for a long time. And I was juggling back in 2016 when we founded the company, containers or serverless. And I made a bet on serverless. I felt that particularly what was going on in AWS around Lambda, but serverless being much bigger than just Lambda, as we've both talked about at length, was the path to go. And today I love telling people that when they use CloudZero's product, that zero EC2 is harmed in the making of their data and their transactions, right? And we have no regrets. It's allowed us to go faster. It's allowed us to have a smaller team. It's allowed us to think differently about operations and development. In fact, we really only have folks who focus on building the software that we deliver. Our operational footprint is tiny, and it's super powerful. I got in conversation with Joe Emerson over at a branch, actually, on a conversation about this, which is, it's a total mindset change when you go and build on serverless. So CloudZero has been all in on this from the beginning. We got so, enamored with serverless that we thought, can we build a solution specifically for the serverless community? But along on that journey, we realized that there was a bigger problem, that engineers, the folks who are building things, they are at the center of what is a kind of existential threat, I think, to cloud computing in general, which is that every engineering decision is a buying decision, and that the engineers don't have the data to make good buying decisions. So we realized that we could build a product that would take all of that observability data that we were pulling into our platform, but then turn it into cost metrics that could guide engineers to make better buying decisions and build more efficient systems.
And I guess so with serverless, or at least truly serverless services, where you have a pay-per-use pricing model, your observability also becomes your cost tracking, because the same data is going to go towards your bill as well as any observability platform that you use. The fact that you've got a Lambda invocation and then API gateway call and the DynamoDB GET operation in one transaction means you have a cost associated with each of those things, but also one transaction from the observability point of view as well. So really interesting that there's this overlap between the two, paradigms of looking at operation from the cost point of view, but also from the observability and debugging point of view as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most people, I think, thought of the cost problem is a reporting issue, right? And it's so much more than that. In fact, if you look at the data streams of information that are coming out of any cloud environment, the cost data is actually one of the richest, most interesting kind of streams of information. When you think about that data in terms of events, of activities, of things that are happening at a point in time, versus thinking about it as a spreadsheet of information that needs to have a bar chart or a pie chart on top of it. So we had that philosophy already to be very event-driven and very kind of motivated by the data. And when we layered the cost aspect on top of that and started thinking about it from more of a cause and effect point of view, we knew we were onto something. And we've always been very focused on the developer workflow, on the kind of developer relationship to cost and usage. And more power to people if they have embraced serverless and they really are getting the maximum effect of that architecture. No doubt, I think that's the future. But we have customers that run the gamut of everything that you could possibly manage. We have folks who are spending a few bucks in the cloud, and we have folks who are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in the cloud, and they have literally every possible service combination you can imagine. Lots of EC2 still out there, lots of RDS, lots of self-hosted things, a ton of Kubernetes. I cry just a little bit when I see it, but it is, I do see serverless growing every year, and I'm always excited to see customers building on serverless. And I love helping people. People should reach out to me if they want to talk about it, because we've been doing it for 6-7 years now, which feels like an eternity actually in this space. And there's still a ton of people just getting started.
Yeah, and speaking about the developer making decisions, and that always has a cost implication that we don't always understand, at least not when we make the decision. One thing came up recently. So Luke Van Donkersgood, who I had on this podcast recently, who is a lead engineer at the PostNL, which is the national post service in the Netherlands. He had a really good tweet about a problem that they had recently, where a developer made, I think, like a one-line mistake and forgot to cache the credentials they got back from Secrets Manager in the Lambda function, so that instead of calling Secrets Manager and then cache the credentials, they will call Secrets Manager on every invocation. So as you can imagine, you're charged, 10,000 requests is about 5 or 10 cents. So when you have a large number of invocations, and they do because they're PostNL, the National Postal Service, that add up to a reasonable amount of money at the end of the month. And in fact, I think they found out that this had happened when they had a billing alert for the account, which was set, luckily, reasonably low for a company of that size. So they got an alert when it hit about $2,000. They looked into it, and if you look at the graph that Luke attached in his thread, which I have included in the show notes, you can see very clearly that immediately after the mistake was deployed, there's a jump in a number of metrics. But of course, because people weren't looking at those metrics, and the fact that the cost data doesn't come up straight away from AWS billing, it takes a 8-10 hours delay, means that people missed that until they got the account level alert. So I guess a couple of things you can learn from that. One of that is, billing alert does work. You need to have that to prevent the worst case scenario being worse than it really needs to be. But also, you want to monitor things and make sure that when you deploy changes, you keep an eye on things and just check. But then again, I think whenever you have to rely on discipline, you are setting yourself for failure. And that's where we really need tools that can automate a lot of these things. So the first thing that came to mind when I saw that tweet was, I remember Cloud Zero. I looked at that a while back for some clients, and remember the stuff that the guys were doing. They have, and you guys have this cost pattern comparison for every month.
We do a lot of anomaly detection. Yeah,
exactly. I wanted to get your take on the whole thing and how Cloud Zero would be able to say customers in similar situations. I imagine you should be able to detect the fact that there's a significant change in spending pattern post-deployment within a few hours once the billing data starts to come in. But yeah, I'll let you tell us about Cloud Zero and what you guys can do in terms of this automated anomaly detection.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things that I think people should do regardless, you know, whether they're using a platform like Cloud Zero or not. You know, turning on billing alerts is a obvious one, you know, trying to keep good kind of tabs on kind of key metrics of your system. These are things that anybody can do. But at the end of the day, you know, these things get really complex. You know, you've been building, you know, serverless systems for a while. Like, there are some amazing kind of emergent behaviors that, you know, things that just emerge from the systems that we create. And it's very hard to predict what's going to happen. You know, these kind of these side effects that occur, some of it because of the kind of, you know, stateless nature and a kind of operation of Lambda and other, you know, components and things like that. You know, people are starting to adopt, you know, other kind of orchestration like step functions and stuff like that. But there's still these just very kind of emergent behaviors that are kind of just take us by surprise. And I hear about it all the time. You know, the example you gave, what I saw when we got, you know, started talking about that, I was like, it seems like there's not a day that goes by where I don't hear some story where, oh, we made a very small change. We made a one-line change of code, or we changed the configuration, or we did something, and that had kind of far-reaching impact to the bill. And it's because every, you know, today in this world that we live in, right, for engineers, like every engineering decision in the cloud is a buying decision. You know, every line of code I write is a buying decision. I make 20 API calls that costs, let's say, 20 cents. If I decide I make 2 million API calls, maybe I just spent $2,000, right? And the question is, should I have done that? Did I know that it was going to happen? So in the case of Secrets Manager, that's one of those services that I've always kind of been fearful of in certain ways because of the pricing model. I'm a much bigger fan of Parameter Store for that reason. And you can store secrets very securely in Parameter Store as well. There's no reason you have to use Secrets Manager unless you have, you know, secret rotation requirements. But in, you know, in that example, yeah, they were calling that API like crazy. So what we are constantly doing when our system's in place is looking at all of the data that's coming in from the environment. We're looking at the cost usage data. We're looking at other activities, other operations, and the system, because it's event driven, we try to react as quickly as we can. You know, the cloud providers are not good about consistently delivering cost data, but the second we get enough information into the system to start seeing a trend emerge, this is where our anomaly detection, which is also built on top of Lambda, is kind of goes to work. It's constantly plotting out what it expects to happen in the environment. It's building models with every kind of drop of new information. And when we see things start to diverge from what we expect, we're looking at two factors. We're looking at velocity, like how fast are we moving away from the norm? And what's the volume, you know, like what's the total, like overall kind of runaway cost. And that kind of dictates how quickly we're going to react and send an alert. So if we saw something moving very fast and very expensive, very quickly, we're going to send an alert. And that alert will go out in most cases to our customers via Slack, because that's where most people love to live these days. They'll get email too if they want that, but I love Slack. So, and we're very targeted. So one of the things you set up when you use Cloud Zero is you set up your teams and you set up your products and features and the things that you, the developer, you care about, because you probably don't care about the millions of things that are going on. You care about the things that are related to the lines of code that you wrote. So we'll even attach that to unique Slack channels. So let's say, you know, they make this configuration change and that causes a Secrets Manager to kind of run away. We would know the team that was responsible for that. We would know the Slack channel that was tied to that. We would see the anomaly occurring and would be sending an alert directly to that team as quickly as possible, you know, could be within hours, to let them know that something has gone off the rails, right? And our goal is to tell people about things when it's a few hundred dollars, not, you know, because then it's kind of like a learning, you know, experience, you know, that you paid a couple hundred dollars for. Not a $10,000, like, uh-oh, am I going to get fired, you know, kind of mistake. So, yeah, I mean, we would have loved to have helped them. You know, it is, it's a powerful thing. A lot of our customers have gotten into the mode where their engineers, after they deploy something, will will stand by and wait for any anomalies to appear before they declare that the work is done, so to speak, because of all these kind of emergent behaviors and things and observations that need to be done to understand your cost profile.
That's obviously a good thing to do, and I think everyone should do it. And I think charity majors often talk about how it's so easy to just, after you deploy, check your production, see if it still works. And even if your monitoring system is not picking things up, doesn't mean that there's no problem. You just keep an eye on things, make sure that you haven't missed any alerts or stuff like that, which is great when you've got talking about system uptime and it being operational. But I think for cost data, because there's such a big delay, oftentimes if I deploy today, I won't find out until I come back into the office tomorrow that something has gone really, really strange, gone out of whack. And I think that's where it becomes a little harder for someone to be keeping an eye on things and making sure there's no divergence in the spending pattern there. So I think tools that can automate is still necessary here.
It needs to be automated because there's no way you're going to keep up with it. And of course, you don't want the management of your monitoring solution to become the thing that is the most complicated part of building your products. If you find yourself in a place where you're having to hire a team that's the size of your engineering team to manage all of your monitoring tools, you've got a problem probably. And so, we've made it very automated. The only thing you're defining in Cloud Zero is the teams and the products and the features. And then the rest is, autopilot essentially. And of course, sometimes the data, and this is where we, kind of push on the cloud providers a little bit, sometimes the data doesn't show up as fast as we like, but we're always getting faster and faster. And particularly as we start thinking about predicting things, we can start with some very small signals. So we don't have to wait very long before we can start to notify people. The other thing I would say is, Charity loves to say, a lot about testing in production. I love testing in production. I think there's actually no testing like testing in production. Particularly when it comes to serverless stuff, and it might be a little bit crazy, but the answer is, you really don't understand how much something costs until you watch it run, and your monitoring solutions don't really understand everything about what's affecting those costs either. I want to give you an example from one of our customers that they made a very small configuration change that resulted in a particular part of their system phoning home, and they deploy kind of an agent or a system out to lots of endpoints all over the world. And that system started phoning home a lot. And you would think that, a change like that would immediately show up as like a big red blip in terms of system load, activity, all kinds of things kind of falling apart behind in the back end, where you had something phoning home once a day. Now it's phoning home every 15 minutes. And you have hundreds of thousands of deployed, devices out in the world. That would be a big problem. Well, thanks to content delivery, CDNs and things like CloudFront or Akamai, nobody noticed, right? But that stuff is wicked expensive. So that customer was on their way to having a multi-million-dollar network bandwidth cost hit their bill, and within hours they were going, "What is this?" And they tracked down the change that they had made using another feature that Cloud Zero has, where we can actually pull events from the from your CI/CD pipeline. So whatever tool you're using, if you're using GitHub Actions or you're using CircleCI or something like that, you can actually wire in Cloud Zero to that, so that whenever you push a change in your environment through your pipeline, we get a notification of that as well. And that becomes a marker that allows us to start aligning things. So when we identify an anomaly and we see a change that occurred around the same time, now that tells a story that an engineer can go, "Oh." And so within moments, they're basically being able to isolate the line of code or configuration change they made that is tied back to that cost overrun. And that allowed them to basically, like I said, turn that what would have been a multi-million-dollar mistake into just a few, it was maybe a little bit more than a few $100 for them, given how fast it was going. But they absolutely would have been, they would have been making that really painful call to their cloud provider, asking them for a rebate, which honestly, they don't do very often anymore.
Well, considering how often that these kind of things happen, they can't just be always the one that's out of pocket. And I guess for listeners who are wondering and about testing in production, just so that we are on the same page, when we say testing in production, we don't mean instead of traditional testing methodologies. We mean you don't stop testing your system even when you go to production. There's a whole school of thought and practices around how do you safely test in production, including things that you may have heard about, things like canary deployments, chaos engineering, as well as good old observability. All falls into that category of how do you continue to test the system and make sure that it's actually working, even if your local test is green. And I love that this
more of a philosophy, right? If you just go and try to start testing your production without having other controls in place, you are going to have a bad time. By the way, you're right. I think it's important that you mention that.
Yeah, I think people just hear the name testing in production sometimes to just assume, oh, right. So instead of having unit tests, you just deploy to production and then try it out and see if it works. Well, no, that's not what people do.
I mean, it is a form of chaos engineering, I guess you could say.
But then chaos engineering is about teaching you things that you should have learned. But then there are other cheaper, more safer ways to learn those things. You don't have to do that in production. And I think that's one of the things that chaos engineers will probably tell you, just don't do it in production until you're ready, until you've done everything else.
Yeah, there's good chaos and there's bad chaos.
So some of the things that you've mentioned there, those are all like really common problems people run into. And I love the success story that you just said there. It's basically either an existential problem for the company with that kind of bill coming their way, or spend a few $100s and, like I said, treat that as a lesson, somewhat expensive lesson, but it's better than going out of business. But one of the things I often hear pushback is, some of these tools are expensive. So you have to strike a balance between having cost control versus how much do you spend and invest into having that control. And like you said earlier, if you end up having to hire a lot of engineers to keep cost under control, then that's a really big problem. So I guess two questions for you there is, what is the pricing model for Cloud Zero? And also, what sort of data do you consume from the AWS account? Do you rely mostly on AWS billing, or do you also collect other data from the environment, like access to CloudTrail data and things like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So one of the things that Cloud Zero's tried to kind of disrupt a little bit is kind of the cost of these solutions in some ways. Now, I'm a big fan of consumption-based pricing, as I think anybody who's a real lover of cloud understands, like that is the future. And so the question really becomes like, well, all right, so what is a platform like Cloud Zero consuming? What really drives our consumption? How is that? And I think it's pretty obvious to say that it's like anything. How much data are we pulling in to the system? So the first question we have to ask is, well, how much data are we going to pull in? And the honest truth is, people who spend more produce more data. And so we know that if we have a general idea of how much you're spending, we can map that onto a general idea of what it should cost. But it doesn't mean that we need to just take a variable percentage of spend, which is such a common pricing model in this space. However, that really dictates how much data we're going to consume. But what we've changed is we typically engage with our customers around a fixed model that is built around tiers of growth based on how much data we think we're going to be consuming because of how they're going to grow. And what that means is that as they grow and shrink and change and things over the year or whatever, life of the contract, they're not going to have another variable component that they might perceive as a tax on their innovation. We didn't want to be that. So we'll work with folks on that. And that pricing model works really well for people who are spending maybe $10,000 or more per month on the cloud. For people who are spending less than that, for that, it's a very kind of low price point that, you know, we're happy to talk with them about. It's more focused on kind of the smaller startup companies, where, you know, a typical customer under that level is really not going to be spending very much money. We don't want this to be an expense. And then the last piece I would say about our pricing is that at the end of the day, a platform like ours should pay you back. You should be able to really clearly see that it saved you money. Our greatest benefit is helping people not spend money on mistakes, right? Or very quickly address those mistakes so that they don't become expensive. And in that regard, we help people, you know, typically save, you know, somewhere between 20 or 30% on, you know, mistakes they've already made. And then it's really hard to calculate how much money they didn't spend. But we're pretty good about it, given, you know, just how many anomalies the system is pumping out and recommending. So there's a lot of data that comes to the platform. So to the second piece of your question, like what data does come into the Cloud Zero system? So cost and usage data, absolutely. And we cover all of the, you know, cloud providers that are out there, GCP, AWS, Azure, but also a lot of the other services that people use, Snowflake, Databricks, Mongo, DB, even some of the management systems that folks are tracking, like New Relic, for example. Like, they want to see all of these costs in one place. So we're pulling in all that cost and usage data that we can get out of the bill, so to speak. And then we're also looking at metrics for use cases like Kubernetes. We're pulling metric data out of Kubernetes. We have a very lightweight agent that sits on the cluster, pulls out CPU, memory, you know, performance metrics. And that allows us to calculate down to the pod what your costs are and understand how that's operating. And then we can also look at things like the cloud metrics, like CloudWatch metrics, for example, right? And that'll help us break apart spend from things like ECS, if you're using that, or even looking at, you know, other CloudWatch metrics in RDS or whatever types of services you're using. We've got some ideas about some other data sources that we can pull. And, you know, the good news is we've built this, you know, very serverless event-driven platform that's going to allow us to start layering more and more into that. The goal is always, how can we get faster and more accurate in presenting information to our customers? And when we do find something, how can we bring more data to bear so that they can triage and address that problem in the moment without having to go and research a whole bunch of stuff elsewhere?
Okay, so you mentioned that most companies get their money back from using Cloud Zero by preventing the kind of mistakes that they will end up making. And what kind of mistakes that do you often see in people's accounts? I guess for me, I'm most interested in the AWS because I've personally seen some really horrific mistakes people make. Really simple things that has outsized the impact on the AWS billing. What are some of the, I guess, more common or more memorable mistakes that you've come across?
We could talk about this all day. You know, it's truly amazing. You have something in like AWS where you have literally infinite choices to make. There are infinite ways that you can also screw up. It's kind of like a million ways to die in the West, right? You know, there are a million ways to make to spend $1 million in AWS, and you know, you could theoretically write some very small code that would spend tens of thousands of dollars in a heartbeat if you weren't paying close attention. Some of the, you know, craziest things are, you know, particularly in the serverless space, where I'll see organizations that have a CloudWatch logs bill that is like a magnitude greater than their actual Lambda compute bill. You know? And so they'll have this unbelievable CloudWatch bill that, you know, you just kind of go, what is going on there? And you realize the ops team has come in, turned on debug logging while nobody was paying any attention. And it is spewing gigabytes and gigabytes, maybe terabytes of data into CloudWatch logs, and nobody was paying attention, right? Because the engineer's like, I didn't make a change. Who did this, right? No, they changed the environment variable from info to debug, and boom, you know. And where does that manifest itself? In the bill, right? So that one's pretty common. I see that one a lot. But the other kind of crazy stuff, a lot of it revolves around network mistakes, routing mistakes, VPC things, everybody's favorite NAT gateway, managed NAT gateway costs. Kubernetes is a huge offender here. People build out these high available Kubernetes clusters that spread across AZs, and some people have gotten super aggressive about availability, and they go, oh, I'll just spread this out across regions. And then they have east-west traffic going between the nodes. And in a very short period of time, they just have an enormous network bandwidth bill. Or they got the routing wrong, and they're sending all their traffic out of AWS and back in. And that is also a very painful mistake. But my favorite example that I think is that I see way more often than people would expect is one related to one of my second favorite service, maybe third favorite service, was just good old fashioned S3. Most people look at the S3 data costs and go, this is not cheap. You know, this isn't that expensive. Great. I'm going to store a bunch of data in here. No problem. But there's two types of S3 problems that I see that really rack up the bill. One, people don't think enough about the access patterns for how they're accessing that data. Developers will sit down, build some code, go, you know, it's really helpful in my application if I just load the data whenever I need it. And then they go off and do other things. They put that information into a for loop somewhere. And next thing they know, their code's making millions of API calls to S3. They may have like 100 kilobytes of data in there, but they're pulling that data out of S3 millions of times a day. And those API calls rack up a bill, right? And then when you point this out to them, they go, oh, I could have made that call once a day. And it's a single line change, and it's really fast to fix. But you know, if you're not paying attention to the cost, you're not bringing cost data into the conversation when you're building, you miss this one entirely. And then the other one is when the ops team goes in and says, oh, let's just flip the bit and this data looks old. Let's add Glacier to the mix. And suddenly you have tons of small objects and who knows what, all getting written at Glacier. And then somebody unknowingly goes, oh, wait, I need that data. And they pull it out and it starts this vicious thrashing that goes on in S3, pushing data into Glacier, pulling it out. And like that gets expensive very fast, without a doubt. And it's really hard to notice because developers doing something over here, other people over here messing around with the data, and they're not talking to each other. But those are some of my, those are some of my favorite ones that I see quite often, unfortunately.
Yeah, that CloudWatch one hits home pretty hard. I've seen a lot of that, and it's very common with Lambda, just because it's so easy to just collect logs. And if you're just doing console.log, or if you're using some languages which logs are more because of verbose than others, it's really easy to collect lots of logs that you don't really use very much.
Yeah, and you can get a double whammy on this, actually, if you're using an APM tool, an observability tool, because some of those systems will go in, instrument things, drop a Lambda function in your environment to pull all that data across the wire and bring it back into their monitoring solution. I have literally cut customers' bills in half by reconfiguring how they set up Datadog. And it sneaks up on them because in the dev environment, it's super cheap. Nobody notices. But then it goes into production, and then over time, their usage grows, and then they're wondering, why is everything cost so much? And you're like, it's because you're paying the tax twice. You know, all this data is being written, and then Datadog is thrashing, you know, with all this information as well. And you go, why don't we just reconfigure this? And they're kind of like blown away. They're like, wait, this product that I'm using that isn't even part of my production infrastructure is just pulling all this data. That's the reason my bill is so high. Yep. Afraid so.
Yep. And then that's also the fact that by default, when you create a new log group, it's set to never expire. So if you're also shipping your logs elsewhere, then you are paying the storage cost, multiple times, basically it's cumulative. So if you don't change your default, your retention, then you're going to be paying more and more every month for storage for CloudWatch logs. And then you're going to be paying for processing twice, once at CloudWatch, another time at Datadog or whatever platform that you're using that ingests all of your logs as well. So there's a lot of small nuances that can all come back and bite you unless you know what it is that you're looking for and what are some of the default things you should be doing in your account. So I guess I want to switch gear a little bit now and maybe talk about some of the sort of bigger picture stuff because the last couple of years has been pretty crazy. We are just experiencing a new banking crisis in the US and probably soon in the Europe as well. But before that, you know, the whole sort of VC sort of culture has really shifted in the last year, maybe 18 months. And you're seeing companies going from this growth at all cost mentality to now, you know, owning companies that can, that are efficient, are getting funded and are getting, you know, everyone is looking at their cloud cost and trying to rein that in and be more efficient. What have you seen in the market change? Are you seeing, you know, more companies looking at talking to you guys about how can they keep things under better under control and maybe getting help from you about, you know, regarding how to be more efficient in terms of their AWS spending, maybe not necessarily cheaper, but more efficient so that they get the same value without all the waste that they didn't care about before?
Yeah, this, it is. There has been a lot of change. And it started, you know, it started to happen well over a year ago, but it really, obviously this year, it's really come into full force. I was at the Sassiter conference last fall, and I attended a lot of presentations, a lot of them given by VCs talking, and where they would typically be on stage talking about growth, 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 there was a very clear shift. Everyone was talking about efficient growth, right? We don't want you to grow it at all costs. We want you to grow efficiently. It is efficient growth at all costs. And, you know, very importantly, if you're a SaaS business or you're a cloud, you know, driven business where the cloud is ultimately, you know, kind of that's your factor. That's how you deliver value to the world. That's your second most expensive line, you know, top level business expense. You've got headcount and then you've got your cloud bill. And it's time, you know, the VCs and the private equity world is asking all of their portfolio companies across the board, hey, you all have to start thinking differently about this. And the truth is that like a lot of these companies, particularly in the startup world, I think have been funding their, you know, really aggressive pricing models with VC dollars. And what I mean by that is, you know, they came up with pricing models that were meant to drive that aggressive growth with under the belief that, well, when it came time to raise more money, they'd be able to raise more money. And it didn't matter that they weren't profitable. It didn't matter that their margins weren't actually that good. And this ties into something that CloudZero has really focused in on as well. It came from a lesson I learned before starting CloudZero when I was trying to forecast the cost of a new system that I was building. And, you know, a lot of people, when they think about forecasting, they go, well, I'll look at past costs and I'll project out what I think that'll be. Well, if you're building a system from scratch, you have no past data. And so I was trying to figure out, how am I going to stay under budget with this system that I'm building in AWS and not, you know, end up designing something that's going to cost $1 million when my budget at the time, crazy true story, was only $3,000, right? And what I realized is, you know, my system does something. It delivers value. And what I needed to think about was the unit of value. What does it cost to deliver that? And I was building a scanning system to scan the security of websites. And so I was like, all right, well, what's my cost per scan? And if I knew what my cost per scan was, then I could project out when I'd run out of money, right? And this, you know, broadly in the whole industry, this is kind of referred to as unit cost or unit economics, understand the unit economics of the system you build. And this lends itself really well to serverless systems, but it applies everywhere. But this is something that we've really embraced and has become kind of at the forefront because of this change in the market that we've seen, where the VCs, the startups, when they're going out for another round of funding, they're being asked, hey, what are your true margins? How are you managing your cost of goods sold? What are you actually profitable? And they can't just like guess and put it in a spreadsheet anymore. They're being asked to show the numbers, show their work. And so this other source of information that comes into CloudZero's platform is something we call business telemetry. which is application metrics. We have an API and a whole system for consuming application metrics, like how much compute time or how many transactions is a customer consuming? How many scans is, if you're a scanning system, how many messages are you sending? How many logins are occurring per hour? Whatever it is that's kind of tied to the unit of value that you deliver, we can consume business metrics associated with that and then correlate that with the cost so that we can produce an instant picture into your unit costs. So a lot of customers come into our platform and they see what their cost per X is or their cost per customer. And this is something that's become really powerful for Cloud Zero. When I onboard a new customer, I know exactly how much that customer is costing me. And I can break apart all of the spend in my environment and know down to all of the kind of individual components, what is contributing to that spend. The most powerful example I'll give of that is we've broken apart, like all platforms out there, there's a beating heart of a database somewhere, right? We use Snowflake. We break apart our Snowflake costs based on cost per query per customer. And I can tell you exactly how much, individual query runs, how much that costs for a single customer. And this is really powerful because when I have a cost spike and I'm a developer trying to troubleshoot this, I can drill all the way down and go, oh, well, wait a second. All my costs are coming from Snowflake. All right, let me go in. What is going on in Snowflake? And typically this is just a big blob of spend. Nobody really understands what's going on. But I can draw all the way down and be like, it's this query that happens to be run quite often by this customer. And great, now I know what I need to do. I can optimize that query. I can change the data access patterns. I can think differently about this. And it's all driven by the unit economics piece of this. And that part has become really key in what we're seeing happening in the market. Because right now, I think we're in a place where a lot of companies by the middle of the year are going to start failing, unfortunately. A lot of startups that have been operating unprofitably for a while are going to start failing. And this is the time for them to really get sharp about what their true margins are, what their true COGS are, all of those elements. If they can't do this, it could just be, the end for some of them. And I think that's really unfortunate, but it's the reality that we're living in. That and, hopefully we don't have another banking crisis. That it has been a roller coaster of a start of a year, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it's a unit. This discussion around the unit cost was always the core tenets of FinOps or FinDev. One of the hidden superpowers of pay-per-user pricing model you get from serverless. But whenever I kind of bring it up and talk to people, they just didn't seem to care. They don't seem to understand. That just never seemed to be a case where there is that's market pressure to force you to understand, what is your unit cost because no VC is asking for it. But sounds like that might be changing. There may be some glimmer of hope for more people to really understand the FinOps and try to take advantage of it once you grok what's the cost associated with individual features, because at that point you can work out what's the return on investment for doing this work or not to do it, and what's the cost for this bug. Do you fix it and save yourself 10 cents per month or leave it be because who cares, it's 10 cents per month, whereas you're going to be paying an engineer, $100 a day or maybe an hour more like to try to fix this thing that's going to cost you 10 cents a month.
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy. And the other, I think, really cool thing about unit economics is, just don't be afraid of the fact that the word economics in there. This is actually something that's enormously useful to engineers, because it is in everybody's best interest to understand the performance of the systems they're building. And the reality is that there is a absolutely tight coupling between the efficiency of the system that you're building and its, and the performance and the cost effectiveness of it. How well architected a system that you've built is directly tied to how efficiently it runs. And everybody should be cognizant of, well, what is this thing, built to do, and how much does it cost to do it, right? And that's where you know, it drives, I think, great engineers to really build even better systems when they have this data. It's super powerful.
Yeah, especially with serverless, where time is money, longer compute time means more expensive invocation. So, you know, this is two birds with one stone if you optimize it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but then again, you know, it goes right back to the point of knowing where do you spend the energy and time and the engineering cost to actually optimize something, knowing that you can only do that once you figured out which part of your system is worth optimizing, because a lot of them probably they may be suboptimal, but if something runs once a day, it's not going to have a big impact. You're not going to move the needle. But if something that's inefficient and runs millions of times a day, then suddenly you're looking at a very different return on investment on optimizing that function, besides the fact that you're going to get better performance and all that for your customers. It's great to see where maybe hopefully at that point where some of that efficiency that comes from cheap money being available from VC now actually driving, it's going away, and people have to be smarter and actually be better at this whole engineering thing.
Yeah, it's true. It's really happening. And I think it's a great thing, actually. But it is a painful wake-up call for a lot of companies. And, you know, folks are going to have to kind of adapt to this. But at the end of this, I think it's actually going to do something even more important. It's going to save the cloud, because I've been hearing, you know, this kind of growing conversation around repatriating assets out of the cloud and into the data center, which I think is absolutely the wrong way to go, unless you have a very, very specialized use case, in which case you should be totally vertically integrated in what you're trying to achieve. But there's no reason to pursue that course of action in almost 99% of the, ways. But people are fed up. They're frustrated. They're struggling around this. And I think a lot of it is because they've forgotten that, like I said earlier, that every engineering decision is a buying decision. And they're trying to solve this cost problem. They just naturally gravitate to finance. Finance will solve this. Maybe they can figure out how to negotiate a better contract. Maybe we can buy more ROIs and savings plans. Maybe we can solve this problem this way. But at the end of the day, it is an engineering problem. The people who made the buying decisions are the engineers. And you give them the data. Well, everyone in this space, we're fantastic problem solvers once we have the data. And that's why, you know, we've really focused in on serving that use case. And it's really paid off for a lot of our customers.
Yeah, I often say to customers that the biggest mistake they can make is to not give the developers access to billing information on the AWS accounts, because there's no feedback loop. People will do stuff, they have no feedback loop to understand what's the impact on the decision that they've just made to use one service over another, or the way they've implemented polling instead of something that's more event-driven, for instance. It's a very small thing, but you're just taking that feedback loop out of the equation altogether. So engineers can't do the right thing, even if they want to.
Yeah.
So Eric, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. I hope that you guys are doing well. I hope Cloud Zero continues to grow, because this market is definitely needing, well, a lot of companies are needing your help to help them keep the cloud cost under control, especially as you said, the number of horror stories you keep reading on social media, it's a daily thing. There's always someone somewhere learning about some quirks, about some AWS services somewhere.
Yeah, there's no shortage of stories there, but it is starting to worry me a little bit that we're still struggling. You know, so many people are struggling with this, but that's why we're here. Yeah, and I'd love to continue the conversation. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, they can find me on Twitter, or just shoot me an email at Eric@ cloudzero.com. But you know, we've got free trials, and we'd be happy to talk to anybody who might be thinking about this problem, and I'd love to help them.
Yep, and if you want to get in touch with Eric or Cloud Zero, I've left their information on the show notes, so please feel free to go and check them out yourself. As Eric said, there's a free tier, so you can always just try it out yourself and see how it's going to help you potentially save millions in the wasted $80.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Jan. It's been great talking with you.
Likewise. Take easy, man. Okay. Bye-bye. So that's it for another episode of Real World Serverless. To access the show notes, please go to realworldserverless.com. If you want to learn how to build production-ready serverless applications, please check out my upcoming courses at productionreadyserverless.com. And I'll see you guys next time.